It had endured a lengthy period as an exclusive school for young boys, and wartime use as a recuperation site for the wounded. It had served as a town museum, and from that it had become what it was today, a dispirited hotel in need of a deep infusion of cash. Even the peonies and hydrangeas, which massed brightly along a stone wall separating the car park from an expanse of lawn, could not do much to change the air of better times gone by that hung over it. Isabel's digs were high in the building and accessed by so many staircases, fire doors and corridors that she reckoned she would require a trail of breadcrumbs to find her way down to breakfast in the morning. But they also had the virtue of being two spacious rooms and a bathroom, although their windows looked out upon rooftops from one, a corner of the castle from another, and from a third, heavily curtained, the building next door. When she opened those last curtains to let in more light, she was greeted by the sight of an elderly gentleman wearing what appeared to be a onesie. This was unbuttoned, displaying his concave chest, through whose grey hairs he was meditatively running his fingers. He saw Isabel and waved gamely. She jerked the curtains closed and vowed not to open them again. She unpacked quickly. She'd rung down to reception for ice and lemon, and while she was laying out her toiletries on the white wicker cart that served as the bathroom vanity, the ice and lemon arrived. Room service was the same person who'd checked them into the place and carried their bags to their rooms. A boy in the vicinity of 20 who favoured false eyelashes and black liner and whose ear gauges had created holes through which a golf ball could have been hit. She saw that he'd brought her a single drinking glass with two pieces of ice in it and one slice of lemon lying perkily at the top. She'd assumed requesting ice meant a bucketful, small though that bucket might have been, and that lemon would mean a plate of slices. But that obviously was not going to be the case. She stopped herself from complaining so early in the game. For all she knew, the poor boy would serve the dinner as well, and she didn't fancy him spitting into her food. And she thanked him as graciously as she could. Then she went to the bedside table where she'd stowed her vodka and tonic. Considering this was going to be her only drinking opportunity while in her room just now, she went for strength. A quarter cup of tonic accompanied vodka that topped up the glass. She drank deeply. She was owed in more ways than one. It was clear that Thomas Linley had managed a few words with Sergeant Havers before their jaunt to Shropshire. The woman had been cooperation personified, from first to last, no matter the tests that Isabel devised for her. On their one brief stop for petrol and their second to use the ladies, the sergeant hadn't flickered an eyelash at Isabel's, "Buy yourself a bag of crisps or something, as we won't be stopping again." Rather, she had returned from her trip to the ladies with two virtuous apples, one of which she handed over to Isabel. She'd maintained this persona all the way through their interview with the chief constable. If she minded not being introduced to the man, something Isabel was certain the supremely well-bred D.I. Linley would never have failed to see to, she gave no indication of that. She'd merely taken notes, asked a question here and there, and waited for further instruction. The sergeant had also made no comment when shown her accommodation in Griffith Hall, which Isabel had made certain in advance would be suitable only for a novice in a cloistered convent. She had relented about the bathroom, shower, loo and sink, but that must be the absolute limit, do you understand? And the bed needed to be a single, she'd instructed the hotel. If it was more like a camp bed than something suitable for a hotel, all the better. Isabel had long since discovered where Barbara Havers lived, in something of a hut that looked as if it had earlier served as a garden shed. So if the sergeant had thought to utter a word of complaint, Isabel was ready with a reply. But she did not complain. She merely entered, slung her bag on the bed, and asked if the telly worked. Apparently she'd been watching EastEnders from her mother's womb. "You'll have little enough time for television," Isabel had informed her before heading off to her own room. She'd handed over the pile of folders the D.I. Pyre and the C.C. of the West Mercia Police had given to them. "Have a look through these." Havers had blinked, but she gave no hint that dividing up the folders might expedite the process. Before dinner, she met Havers in the bar, as arranged. Someone, no doubt Linley, had put the sergeant into the picture of changing for dinner, but she'd misinterpreted the idea of changing, reckoning it meant just altering one's outfit. All she'd come up with was beige trousers, brown brogues, and a blue blouse that was only travelling towards threadbare, instead of having already arrived at that destination. Isabel's vodka and tonic had mellowed her, though. She didn't mention the sergeant's attire. Instead, she sat upon one of the leather sofas and gestured for Havers to take the other. The sergeant looked confused. Then she cast a glance in the direction of the dining room. She went for apologetic as she said,
"Sorry to bring this up, but, I mean, as we didn't have lunch."
It was clear she'd never been to a hotel, fine or otherwise. A B&B, probably. A pub with rooms, maybe. But a full-service hotel with a bar and restaurant in addition to a breakfast room, not at all. The poor woman didn't know what to do with herself.
"This is how we begin, Sergeant," Isabel told her. "Do sit. They'll bring us menus. I'm ordering a drink. Have one yourself. It's after hours and we're officially off duty."
Havers hesitated. She'd brought several of the investigation's filing folders with her, and she clutched them defensively to her chest. Isabel said,
"Surely Inspector Linley hasn't always forced you to have your meals in, I don't know, little chefs? I can't think that would be quite his cup of tea. Do sit down. Someone will be along. Hotels have a sixth sense about these things."
Havers relented, but she perched on the edge of the sofa. She kept the filing folders hugging her body, clearly expecting this to be a working dinner, and she managed to look as if Isabel would leap to her feet at any second and announce that the joke was on her. Within moments, Isabel's promised someone arrived, menus in hand. As she'd suspected, it was Mr. Eyelashes, etc. She asked him his name.
"Peace," he said.
"I beg your pardon? Your name is Peace?"
"Peace on Earth," he told her. "Mum liked to make statements."
"Did she indeed? Have you siblings, Peace on Earth?"
"End of hunger," he told her. "After that she couldn't get pregnant again. Just as well, you ask me."
He handed them the menus, saying, "Drinks," as he did so. Isabel was more than ready for her second of the evening. She said,
"Vodka martini, straight up with olives, stirred not shaken, if you will. Sergeant, what will you have to drink?"
Havers, she saw, was studying what appeared to be the fancy cocktail list. Her brow furrowed, and her lips were moving as she read the names and their accompanying descriptions. She finally said, airily,
"I think I'll have the same. The vodka thing."
"You're certain?"
Isabel doubted Havers had ever even had a martini.
"Certain as there's snow in the Alps."
Isabel nodded at Peace on Earth.
"Two vodka martinis, then,"
he said. "Will do," and took himself off to the bar to do the mixing there. Isabel wondered if he was also the chef. So far, there appeared to be no one else working in the place.
"Wonder if he's got his mum's skeleton kitted out in the attic," Havers murmured, glancing round the lounge in which they sat.
They were its only occupants. Isabel frowned.
"His mum? You know, beware of the portrait with moving eyeballs and taking a shower if there's a curtain and not a glass door. Anthony Perkins? Janet Lee? The Bates Motel?"
When Isabel made no reply, Havers went on,
"Good God, Gov, have you never seen Psycho?"
She made stabbing motions along with a wee, wee, wee sound.
"All that blood swirling down the drain."
"I seem to have missed it." Havers looked astonished.
"Missed it?"
Her expression suggested that she wanted to ask if Isabel had been in a coma for several decades.
"Yes, missed it, Sergeant. Is it required viewing for anyone considering a holiday and looking for accommodation?" "No, but, well, some things are cultural touchstones, aren't they?"
"I wouldn't disagree, although I'm not sure violent death through shower curtain is one of them." Peace on Earth brought them a bowl of mixed nuts and another of cheese straws. Havers looked at them longingly, but she didn't help herself. Isabel reached for a cheese straw and offered the bowl to her. The sergeant took one and held it, cigar-like, between two fingers, as if waiting permission to put her teeth upon it. When Isabel crunched down upon hers, Havers did the same. Her unnerving accuracy in duplicating Isabel's movements made the DCS wonder whether she'd been practicing the art of mirroring in her spare time.
"What have you gathered so far?"
Isabel asked her, with a gesture at the files they'd been given. Havers referenced the anonymous call that had come into the 999 control center. It had been a man's voice, no name given, and, as all calls were, it had been recorded. The IPCC files had contained a transcript of the call, and it was the transcript that had caught the sergeant's attention. After making the claim of child molestation against Ian Druitt, the voice had said, "I can't abide the hypocrisy. That sod goes after children, boys and girls. He has done for years, and no one wants to see it. It's like the goddamn Catholic Church." Havers said,
"First, I wondered why anyone took the call seriously, Gov. It was like an anonymous letter when you think about it. Someone decides to cause this bloke Druitt aggro, so he rings 999 and makes a claim about him. He doesn't offer proof, but the coppers rush out and make an arrest."
"Paedophilia being something the police are going to take on board at once, Sergeant," Isabel pointed out, leaving the rest hanging there because Havers would know it. The phone call was not unlike someone anonymously ringing the coppers to indicate a neighbour had been seen shoving a body under the patio. Wheels were going to be set in motion.
"Oh, I understand that, but it was the last part, the Catholic Church bit."
Isabel had taken another cheese straw, but she held it midway to her mouth.
"The Catholic Church bit? Child abuse and a Catholic Church. Doesn't that suggest anything to you?"
"Should it? I mean, aside from the fact that it's come out the Catholic priests were diddling children, and their superiors knew it and did nothing about it."
"Exactly, Gov. This bloke Ian Druitt, turns out he was a deacon, not a full-on priest. So he had a superior right here in Ludlow, a superior who could have known all along what he was up to, but did nothing to stop him."
"You're suggesting that that's the reason behind the anonymous phone call, that the Anglican Church did exactly as the Catholic Church has done. Well and good, but where does that take us?"
"To the fact that an Anglican deacon offed himself in the Ludlow police station without ever being told why he was there. Because according to the IPCC report, the PCSO brought him in but said nothing to the bloke because he didn't even know why he'd been told to fetch him, and then the bloke offed himself. That doesn't make sense."
"It makes sense if you consider that, being a deacon of the church, Ian Druitt could have read the handwriting on the wall the moment the PCSO showed up to collect him. What was his name again?" Havers consulted her paperwork. Peace on Earth came to their table with their martinis. She said,
"Gary Ruddock. And what I'm saying, thank you, Peace. May I call you Peace, by the way?"
Isabel said all of this with meaning. Her discussion with Havers wasn't one that she wanted anyone, let alone a hotel factotum, to overhear.
"Fine by me," Peace on Earth said as he placed the drinks in front of them.
Hastily, then, Havers closed the file. She took up her martini, and before Isabel could mention that it was something she might want to savour, she swigged a mouthful as if it were mineral water. Thankfully, the top of her head did not burst into flames, although her comment, "strong," barely made it from between her lips afterwards. Peace had, in the meantime, transformed himself into their waiter. He produced a pad and pen and asked them about their menu choices. Isabel went for the soup, followed by the lamb, medium rare. And Havers, who hadn't looked at the menu and possibly hadn't even seen the menu, said in something of a post-vodka murmur that she'd have the same, although her expression suggested that she didn't know lamb could be cooked in any way other than to a crisp. When the young man had taken himself off, possibly to do the cooking as well, Isabel pointed out to Havers that the fact that Ian Druitt was an Anglican deacon explained two elements of the case. The first was why the phone call to 999 had been made anonymously.
"Most fathers wouldn't want their sons or daughters to be questioned by the police about molestation. They'd want it even less if the molester was a deacon, as it would easily come down to the child's word against a churchman's."
The second was that the deacon had been collected sooner rather than later after the phone call.
"The MP who came to see Hillier, Quentin Walker, told me that Druitt had a boys and girls club here in town. If that's the case, he was in a position of such trust that he needed to be stopped at once if he was messing about with any children in that club."
Havers didn't look convinced, though. Instead, she looked thoughtful before she said,
"Or there's always this, Gov. Someone was trying to get Druitt stitched up for something he didn't do."
Ludlow, Shropshire. It was 11:30, but Barbara knew she had to get out of the hotel and into the air. She also knew that she'd buggered things. The pre-dinner martini had been followed by two bottles of red wine. One cup of coffee, black, strong and sugarless, had done nothing to slap her into sobriety. If the drinking had been designed by Ardrey to see what she would do when offered it, Barbara reckoned she'd failed the test. As for the DCS, she'd not shown the least sign of being even tipsy. Instead of coffee, she'd also had 2 port wines after dinner. Her capacity for drink was astonishing. The only indication she'd given that the drinks were getting to her was when she'd taken a phone call during their dinner. She'd given it a glance and then said to Barbara, "I must take this," and rose to leave the dining room. She headed for the doorway, but she'd veered off course a bit. But even that could have been due merely to a ruck in the carpet. Barbara had heard her say, "But I've hired you to deal with this, haven't I?" before the DCS went out of earshot. Upon her return, Ardrey had looked stony in the face, but whatever the phone call had been about, she'd left the matter wherever she'd rung off on the caller. She seemed expert at compartmentalizing things. After the meal, as they climbed the stairs, Isabel laid out their plans for the following day, which would begin at 7:30 when they met for breakfast. The day would include speaking to the PCSO, who'd been in charge of carting Ian Druitt to the Ludlow station. It would also include a drive to pay a call on the dead man's father, and a conversation with the vicar of St. Lawrence Church, which, according to their paperwork, turned out to be where Ian Druitt had his position as deacon. "Good night to you, Sergeant," were Ardrey's final words, along with, "I hope you sleep well." Barbara surveyed her room on unsteady legs and knew how unlikely was the probability that she would sleep at all. First of all, the room swam round her in such a way that she thought she might not make it across the carpet to the bed. Second, the bed was so narrow and looked so uncomfortable that even if she managed to fall upon it, she reckoned she'd spend the night feeling like a prisoner stretched out on the rack. Not born anywhere near yesterday, Barbara had understood what Ardrey was up to on the journey to Herefordshire and then to Shropshire. As soon as the DCS had announced there would be no stopping for lunch, she'd reckoned that Ardrey was going to use this excursion as an opportunity to push her not only to the edge, but over it. Ardrey's dislike of her had been established early into her tenure at New Scotland Yard, and while Barbara had done nothing to garner anything other than dislike from the DCS, she'd managed to stay clear of absolute malfeasance until she'd taken herself off to Italy in defiance of Ardrey's orders. Providing information to a reporter working for the nation's worst tabloid hadn't helped matters. Doing it more than once had done the job to seal her fate. So now in Ludlow, Barbara found herself quite adept at reading the tea leaves. D.I. Linley might have seen this as an opportunity for redemption, but Barbara knew what it actually was, a design to sink her permanently and to guarantee her transfer to Berwick-upon-Tweed. This room in the hotel was part of it. She didn't need to see Ardrey's own digs to know that they wouldn't resemble this, which had to be the quarters of a former scullery maid, shared undoubtedly with a laundress and the dairymaid, had Griffith Hall had a dairy in its glory years. But Isabel Ardrey was not going to hear a complaint from D.S. Havers, so if Barbara had to sleep on the floor to achieve any comfort at all, she would do so. The drinking, though, had blotted her copybook after an entire day of keeping it pristine. She was pissed all the way to the stars, and this did not bode well for the morrow. She needed to sober up. She also needed a fag. The hotel was a non-smoking establishment. Wasn't everything these days, she asked herself bitterly, so she decided that a walk in the night air might suffice to meet those 2 needs. After splashing water on her face in a bathroom the size of a church confessional, she grabbed up her shoulder bag, made sure she had her fags, and staggered down to reception. No one was there, but she found a neat pile of tourist maps on the counter, along with postcards of the castle and dozens of brochures for various days out in Shropshire. She took up one of the tourist maps and unfolded it. Her vision was doing the polka, but she could still see that the map was heavily given to advertisements for shops, cafes, restaurants and galleries. In the middle of all this was a fairly usable plan of the medieval centre of the town. The presence of the castle made it simple for her to see where she was in Ludlow, across the street from it, and despite the swirling sensation in her head, she was able to plot out a route that would take her through the narrow streets and ultimately deposit her in front of the police station, from which she could then find her way back. Town plan in one hand and fags in the other, she went outside to find that it had rained while she and Ardrey had been at dinner. The cool night air promised sobriety. On it hung the sweet, sharp smell of wood smoke from a fire nearby, something utterly foreign to London, where wood fires were no longer permitted. People cheated on the law and burned them anyway, but it was rare enough that the scent of them in Ludlow was like being thrust back in time. The buildings had the same effect on her. Griffith Hall was part of a line of dwellings that lay claim to the passage of centuries. A plaque on one of the houses indicated that a medieval range of buildings here had been transformed into a Regency terrace by means of altering what faced onto the street, while at the corner, where the lane opened onto Castle Square, a 20th-century café shared a plot of land with a half-timbered Tudor town mansion. Barbara felt like a traveller caught between several time periods, although the sounds of nearby music and happy conversation fixed her in the present. She recognised the chatter of drinkers whose habit with fags did not allow them to do both drink and smoke simultaneously inside a pub that was not in view. She reckoned the drinkers and smokers were mostly students, for across the square she could see a wrought-iron archway that spanned two buildings and made an entrance that was identified by glittering stainless steel letters that indicated the route to West Mercia College. The last thing Barbara wanted to do was seek out a pub, so she lit her first fag and continued on her way. Her head was muzzy. A weekly pint of ale or lager was her usual limit, and she cursed herself for feeling she needed to acquiesce when offered another kind of drink. As for downing a sodding martini, she had to ask herself where congenial cooperation ended and utter mindlessness began. On the high street she encountered only one individual, a man carrying a sleeping bag under his arm and a carrier bag in his fingers. He wore a rucksack and was accompanied by an Alsatian. He looked to be getting ready to doss in the doorway of a distinguished stone building identified on her town plan as the Butter Cross. He was opposite the pavement on which she was walking, so she couldn't get a clear look at him, but she made note of the idea of someone sleeping rough in Ludlow. It seemed unusual. There was no traffic in town just then. Ludlow's nightlife appeared to be restricted to a few pubs, and its restaurants seemed to cater to those who ate early and retired to bed soon afterwards. Following her designated route, Barbara found herself ultimately in a pedestrian passage where the now gated Renaissance flea market promised her a variety of goods that she had no use for. This passage was dimly lit, and she paced along it quickly to emerge onto a curve that her map defined as the point where Upper Galderford Street met Lower Galderford Street. Here, everything was much different. For emerging from the vicinity of the flea market, she found that she'd left the medieval precinct entirely. The roadway was wider, indicating its purpose as a route bypassing the old part of the town. Along it, a terrace of houses stood faced either in dismal grey stucco or in brick with single steps to serve as their porches. The breeze was brisker here, and brisker still when she reached her destination. The town's police station had its position at the corner of Lower Galderford Street and Townsend Close, not far from Weeping Cross Lane, which, according to her map, dropped down to the River Teme. It seemed to Barbara that it was from the river that the breeze took some of its chill. She was surprised by the size of the station. A two-story structure faced with red brick, it was larger than she thought it would be, its traditional blue-and-white lettered police light extending from the southeast corner of the building. Wide stone steps led to a substantial oak door hung with a simple overdoor that was less decoration than shelter from the rain. Barbara climbed the steps. She was sober enough to note that the police station, despite its present disuse, was hung with a CCTV camera that was pointed upon the steps she'd just climbed, as well as upon the pavement and at least part of the street. She also saw what hung to the left of the front door, which was a phone receiver above which potential callers were informed that lifting the receiver would connect them to the Operations and Communications Centre, where what would be asked was the location of the station at which they were standing, their name, their contact number, and their address. Any communications about the 2003 Sexual Offences Act need to be made at one of the following stations, the message concluded. Barbara read those stations and saw from the list that not one of them was Ludlow. This gave her pause. The allegations against Ian Druitt fitted into the 2003 Act. She wondered if the person making the report to the Operations Centre had been informed of that. Indeed, she wondered again, as before, why the operations centre had moved on an anonymous message at all, considering that the basic requirements of identity, phone number, and address had evidently not even been met. However, if the location of the intercom had been identified by the previous investigation, it stood to reason that the digital recording from the CCTV camera pointed at the steps could have shown the person who had used the intercom, once the time of the phone call and the time from the CCTV camera were noted. But all of this went no distance at all to explain why the police station's external phone had been used in the first place, when surely a call box somewhere in town could have served the same purpose. Barbara left the front door, went down the steps, and had a longer look at the station. Several windows on the upper floor were cracked open, which confirmed what C.C. Wyatt had told them. Patrol officers whose beat included Ludlow still used the station when they were out and about. The place was dark now, save for lights on the ground floor, that appeared to illuminate the former reception area. In the back of the building there was a car park, designated for official use. Here she saw a single police car sat in deep shadow, parked at some distance from the building. It stood in a corner with its front end pointing forward into the car park, as if a quick response from someone might be necessary. She was about to turn away from this and continue on her route, when she saw that the vehicle was not unoccupied. Movement from within on the driver's side caught her attention, and from where she stood she managed a glimpse of what looked like a man who'd adjusted his seat so that he could lean far back. Considering the hour, the place, and the situation in Shropshire vis-à-vis policing, she reckoned she was looking at one of the patrol officers assigned to police a large area that included Ludlow. He was having a kip, while, no doubt, a fellow patrol officer kept up appearances by cruising through some of the other towns. When nap time was finished, the other officer would rouse this one by radio. An exchange would be made, another kip enjoyed, after which their policing would resume. It wasn't unheard of, despite its being unprofessional. But Barbara concluded that the more cutbacks fell upon the shoulders of the local Rozzers, the more those cops would cease caring about doing the job as well as it should have been done. Quality Square, Ludlow, Shropshire. "The nephew, is it?" Francie Adamucci asked Chelsea Lloyd. She did one of her signature moves, the one with her hair, casually flipping it off her right shoulder while allowing the rest of it to drape sexily over the left side of her face.
"Really? The nephew? He's seriously too young."
"Which means you fancy the other, I expect." Chelsea gestured sloppily with her lager. It was at least her fourth, but who was counting, aiming vaguely at Jack Cohanan. He was waiting for the foam to allow more Guinness into a pint for a bloke who looked about 183 years old.
"I hear he's married, Fran." "I hear that doesn't make a difference."
Ding listened to her two mates having yet another typical Francie-Chelsea conversation. No matter where a discussion between them began, if they were drinking it always came down to who fancied which male in the immediate vicinity. In this case, there were only three in their line of sight. The old gent eagerly grabbing up his Guinness, the middle-aged owner of the Hart and Hind, and his 20-something nephew, whose name Ding could never remember. There were others here and there in the pub, although the pickings were virtually non-existent. Ding reckoned Jack Cohanan won Francie's interest by default. She'd come out with her friends because she couldn't stand to remain in Teamside. Finn had been forced out to dinner with his mum, after which he'd come home in a mood so foul Ding had not wanted to be anywhere near him. As for Brutus, she'd decided to take his interpretation of friends with privileges straight to heart, which was why she joined Fran and Chelsea.
"You did not! You never!"
This came from Chelsea, who spoke behind her hand like a 15-year-old, all astonishment or whatever.
"Of course I did," Francie told her. "God, Chels, what's the point of fancying someone if you don't make a move? But he's, God, Francie, he's like, I don't know, 40 or something. He was just a bonk," Francie said indifferently. "It's not like I'm planning to marry the bloke. But what if his wife? Separate lives."
Francie mentioned this in a dismissive tone that indicated the wife was a rather boring issue for her.
"They own the pub together and they live together, different bedrooms in the same house. She goes her way and he goes his. How do you know? He told me."
Chelsea's enormous blue eyes grew, if possible, more enormous.
Are you thick or something? That's what married blokes always say when they want it.
Her expression grew shrewd as she considered what Francie had been telling them.
I don't believe you. Where exactly was this heavenly bonk with Jack Cornan supposed to have happened? Don't be such a dim bulb. It happened where bonks always happen in this place. Everyone knows about the rooms above.
And to Ding,
Ding knows, don't you, Ding?
Ding didn't need to reply, since living proof was just coming down the stairs behind the bar, in the persons of two suspiciously bright-eyed individuals. A curvy girl in a leotard and her male companion, from whose fingers dangled a room key with a fob the size of a shoe. He handed this over to the Cornan nephew, along with what appeared to be 2 £20 notes. The nephew nodded, gave the couple a grin, and placed the money not in the till, but rather in what looked like a miniature coal scuttle behind it. Quickly enough, another couple took the room key in hand and climbed the stairs.
O.M.G., was Chelsea's reaction. Don't they even change the sheets? They were clean enough when we used them, Francie told her. Clean enough isn't clean at all. You could get some gross disease.
When Francie shrugged, a girl who didn't have time to consider diseases, Chelsea shook her head.
I do not believe you. I mean, what do you want with an old man, Fran? Like I said, I fancied him. Still do, in fact. And I wanted a bit of a laugh. It's only sex, Chels. If I didn't have to swap for an exam tomorrow, I'd have a go with him tonight as well.
Having said this, she downed the rest of her lager. Ever her cohort, Chelsea did the same as Francie asked Ding if she was ready to leave. But Ding wasn't ready, so she said she'd stay and she'd see the other two girls in the morning. This was agreed to, and the girls went on their way, leaving Ding at the bar asking for another lager from the nephew, while also eyeing the pub owner and wondering why Francie Adamucci, who, let's face it, could have any bloke she winked at, would allow Jack Cornan to poke her. He wasn't bad-looking, Ding had to admit. While he had salt-and-pepper hair, he had plenty of it, and it curled appealingly. If his beard was also greying, it was neatly trimmed and attractive on him. He wore trendy specs, whose round frames gave him an elfin appearance, but he used braces instead of a belt. These were seasonal or holiday-oriented or political, and Ding had always thought, when she thought about Jack Cornan at all, which was hardly ever, that wearing braces made the bloke seem ancient. Definitely too ancient to want to bonk. Unless, of course, he was a wizard in bed. Ding considered Jack, and her consideration led inexorably to Brutus. Was he a wizard in bed? No. At 18 years old, what boy could possibly be, even someone like Brutus, who was going at sex like someone thinking women were about to disappear from the earth? But Jack Cornan, a man whose age had given him decades of experience, his sexual expertise had to be either what Francie had been told or what she'd learned firsthand from experience. Else she'd be taking note of the nephew. Did any of them actually know his name? Ding asked herself. Which she hadn't done, not even when Chelsea had said she fancied the boy. All of this amounted to evidence, Ding decided. If Francie Adamucci fancied Jack Cornan, there was going to be a very good reason. She saw that he was glancing in her direction. He would do, naturally, as not only was she a paying customer, but she was also the only female alone at the bar. She cocked her head and met his gaze with hers. She lifted her lager to her lips and drank. When she put the pint back onto the bar, she ran her tongue over her upper lip to remove the non-existent foam. The nephew moved from the bar to several of the tables that had been abandoned by other college students who, like Francie, had exams or papers that wanted writing or early lectures or tutorials. He set about gathering glasses and wiping moisture rings from tabletops, and in doing so he didn't see that another couple had descended the stairs. Jack Cornan dealt with them, key returned, money handed over, money deposited, and off they went into the night. He turned from that coal scuttle depository and came to the bar to gather the glasses left by Francie and Chelsea. He said to Ding,
"Friends abandoned you, eh?"
And while she could have allowed that to be the conversation starter about Francie and Chelsea, she opted instead for,
"I didn't think you were the one who handled the rooms."
He said as he doused the glasses in whatever substance cleaned them beneath the bar.
"Which rooms?" "You know." "Fact is, I don't. What about the rooms?" "Oh, really, Jack?"
She surprised herself when she used his Christian name. knowing that it signalled something, but at the same time still not entirely sure that she wanted to signal anything just yet.
"That bloke just gave you back the key. With money as well."
"What bloke?" he asked. "What key? Are you hallucinating? Or is it fantasizing?" Then he gave her what she could only call the look. It consisted of a very slight upturn of his lips, an even slighter flare of his nostrils, and a dropping of his eyes to her chest, and a subsequent raising of his eyes to her face. She understood that he was testing. She leaned over the bar to shoot him some additional cleavage. She ran her index finger round the rim of her pint. She said,
"You're having me on, aren't you?
Francie tells me you use those rooms yourself."
"Does Francie indeed?"
He was drying the glasses. His nephew brought a plastic tub of more glasses to the bar. Jack didn't acknowledge him with so much as a glance. He said,
"Francie's been naughty, then."
"I thought she'd keep our little secret."
"And I wager you have lots of little secrets."
Ding ran her finger round the rim of her glass another time. She lifted that finger to her lips and slowly sucked it into her mouth. Jack eyed her.
"Girl, you'd best be careful with that. Blokes will get the wrong idea if you keep it up."
"What makes you think it will be the wrong idea?" Ding asked him.
He was silent for a moment before he said,
"If you've got yourself into that frame of mind, it's not a problem to accommodate you."
It took only 3 seconds for him to slide onto the bar the room key he'd just been given by the latest couple to have used one of the two rooms upstairs.
"Or," he said, "are you just a tease? You have the look of a tease. Come down to it, I wager off you'd scarper."
"I've never been a tease," she said.
"Your words, not mine," was his reply.
He moved off and took up the tub of glasses. As he did so, the nephew rejoined them. He eyed the room key, then he eyed Ding, then he eyed his uncle. He left the key where it lay. Ding took 2 deep draughts of her lager. She was pleasantly lit up, and she asked herself what was the harm, really. It's what everyone did, and in her particular case it was a statement that needed making. She thought that she and Brutus had actually had something. She thought that when he told her that they would only be friends with privileges, it would be easy enough to alter the relationship into something more. But now she knew that was nowhere near to being likely. So she closed her hand over the key. She saw that its fob said it fitted room 2. All she would need to do was to climb the stairs and find the door. She also saw that Jack Corhanan was watching her, his expression a dare. Was she a tease or was she the real thing, like Francie Adamucci? She took up her lager and made for the stairs. She shot him a look. There was no doubt in her mind what he would do. 2 ceiling fixtures in the upstairs corridor shed dim light to direct the way to the pub's 2 bedrooms. Between them an open door displayed what would be a shared bathroom for anyone stopping overnight. But she reckoned sharing that bathroom during overnight stays was a rare occurrence, since the pub owner would be making far more money from letting the rooms out on an hourly basis to anyone wishing to have a bonk. Behind the door that bore the number 1, she could hear both grunting and moaning along with the rhythmic mating call of mattress springs. As she passed, a girl's voice cried, "Yes! Oh my God!" and the mating call intensified, turning her cries into short, pleased shrieks. Ding paced past, gulping more of her lager. It was her intention to down the rest of it. For once, she was feeling absolutely free. She paused in the loo. Wisdom suggested that she use it. As she did so, she heard the grunting from room 1 more clearly. She wondered how long it would take him to finish, and at what point sheer exhaustion might bring on an unsatisfactory conclusion for him. For the girl, it seemed the encounter had been a smashing success. She was no longer shrieking, but had grown silent as her partner laboured on. To flush or not? Ding asked herself. She thought not. She didn't want to embarrass the couple in room 1, although something about the entire room-for-hire situation at the pub suggested they weren't the type to be embarrassed. And she also didn't want to distract the boy from what was seeming to be his extended efforts. So she tiptoed out from the bathroom and made her way to room 2, where she let herself in as quietly as she could. The scent assailed her, coming at her like a hostess over-eager to welcome her company's arrival. It was a blend of unwashed female, undeodorized male, sex, unlaundered sheets, and a heavy application of room spray that failed to cover the other odours. No one had thought to open a window, and Ding went to do so. It was, she discovered, painted shut, and with panes so filthy that she could barely distinguish what it overlooked, which was the cobbled way of Church Street, its street lamps shedding cones of light on two art galleries and a cheese shop. She turned from the window to look at the room. She hadn't switched on the lights, so she saw, in the semi-darkness, that the furniture had been kept to a minimum. A chest of drawers, a seat, sagging armchair, a full-size bed, one bedside table with lamp. Above the bed some sort of print hung, but she couldn't tell what it was. She could tell by the precision of its hanging that it probably had been nailed in place. There were no other decorations, and the bed itself was mattress only, as someone had rid it of its ill-smelling sheets, which now were balled up in a corner. On the top of the chest of drawers stood a large basket filled with potpourri, which she discovered smelled mostly of dust, and next to this was the air scent bottle, which she took up and sprayed till there was none left. Then she downed the rest of her lager. Then she sat in the armchair and waited. It was there more quickly than she expected, not 10 minutes after she'd climbed the stairs. He didn't knock, but merely came into the room. He coughed at the smell, saying, "Jesus Christ! Do you have a thing for lavender?" He made no mention of the room's overall condition. He merely shut the door and, like her, did nothing to illuminate the space. Instead, he slid the braces from his shoulders, pulled his shirt from his trousers, and crossed the room to her. He said, "Not a tease, eh? Am I meant to take that for the truth? You can take it any way you want. You didn't drag me up here, as I recall." He chuckled. "You're a bit of a thing, aren't you? College girl, or something else? What do you think?" "Don't think a thing other than not wanting to get myself stitched up for having a 15-year-old to bed." "How old are you, then?"
18. "What about you?"
"I like you," he said.
"That's not what I wanted to know."
"Oh, I expect it isn't, but that's all I'm saying. Come here, then." And he drew her to her feet and was kissing her before she was prepared for him to do so. He certainly knew how to kiss, she discovered. He kissed in a way that made her want him to go on kissing her into next week. As he did so, he took her hands and put them under his shirt, and put his own on her hips to pull her closer, and then on her waist, and then up and up, till he had her bra unhooked, and was squeezing her nipples just to the edge of pain, and then releasing them the very moment before she cried out, as if he knew, and he certainly knew, and it was pure pleasure shooting down her body just where he wanted that pleasure to go. He released her. He nodded as if she'd somehow proved something he'd been wanting to know. He moved to the bed, and there he pulled his shirt over his head in that way she'd seen men do on the telly when unbuttoning the shirt, which was too much trouble for the hurry they were in. He tossed it onto the bed, and then he kicked off his shoes and lowered his trousers, and she saw he wore nothing else beneath them. She knew she was meant to be doing something, either helping him out of his clothing or removing hers. But she was arrested by the sight of his muscled back, his buttocks with deep creases defining the muscles there as well, his legs and his arms, and as he turned back to her. Which was when she saw the mat of hair on his chest, how the grey mixed with the dark, and how it narrowed at his waist till it spread thickly like a nest for his erect penis, and how it climbed to just below his neck, where the rope, or was it a tie? Or was it the belt of a dressing gown?
"Like what you see, eh? Most girls do."
And she hadn't known what to do, or what it meant, so she'd not said a word. How could she say a single word about the rope, the tie, the dressing gown's belt?
"What are you about, then? Get your kit off, girl. I'm not intending to stand here forever."
And his hand closed over his penis to give it a boost, because she wasn't doing what she was supposed to be doing, which was undressing and crossing to him and straddling him and rubbing herself up and down him so that she could feel how excited she was by the sight and the feel of him, only she wasn't, not now, not ever, not like this. She headed for the door, but she had to pass him, and he grabbed her, saying,
"Hey, what's this, then? Not what you thought? Not hearts and flowers and music and some bloke kissing your neck or whatever instead of this?"
He clutched her crotch, saying as he pulled her against him,
"Believe me, girl, you'll like it rough. What do you think they keep coming back, those mates of yours, those college girls?"
He turned her to the bed. He lifted her skirt. His hands were on the waistband of her tights. She started to scream.
What are you on about? Shut the fuck... Jesus!
He released her. She went for the door, thinking he might try to stop her, but he didn't, of course, because he wasn't a rapist. He was a bloke who had women every which way he wanted them, whenever he wanted them, and if it wasn't going to be her, which it clearly wasn't, he wasn't about to force it to be her. She was down the stairs in a flash. In another flash, she was stumbling across the old pub's floor and pushing out into the night. May 6th. Ludlow, Shropshire. Barbara rang D.I. Linley in the morning. Despite her walkabout on the previous night, she was so hungover that she found that she was actually still pissed. She had barely slept. The reason for this was not only the room heaving to and fro like a ferry on a very bad crossing to France, but also that, upon returning from her walk, she'd roused Peace on Earth from wherever he'd taken himself off to, and she'd asked him to brew for her an entire pot of coffee. Her room being far too small to do any real work in, she'd occupied a table in the residence lounge where she'd had her first, and it would be her last, martini earlier in the evening. During this time of swilling down coffee, she went through every one of the filing folders of information they'd been given. She also made notes dealing with her evening's stroll. She waited till 6:15 to ring Linley from her room. She decided the castle, which she could see from her window, was as good an excuse as any. It was early, yet, but he was an early riser. A woman answered his mobile, however. She said,
"Barbara, hello. We're at a critical moment. He's not quite available."
So Barbara knew she hadn't misdialed. She understood she was speaking to Deirdre Trehair, whose employment at London Zoo resulted in hours as early as the inspector's. Barbara searched for words. She knew the inspector was involved with the zoo's large animal vet, but he played his cards very close when it came to his love life, post the terrible death of his wife, and he'd never directly told her that some of his nights were spent with Deirdre Trehair. She said,
"Not sure I want to know what the critical moment is. Can you have him ring me when it's past?"
and realized, as the remark left her lips, that she might have been wiser to head in a direction different to double entendre. But Deirdre laughed.
"He's scrambling eggs. I'm spellbound by his method. I've never seen them scrambled quite this way." "Word of warning," Barbara told her. "I wouldn't eat them. Far as I know, he can't even make toast." "That's very good to know. Your phone call is a brilliant excuse, then. I'll hand you over to him and finish the eggs myself."
In a moment, Linley's voice said, "Barbara, has something gone wrong?" She replied with,
"I passed every test until dinner, and believe me, sir, she was tossing them in front of me like hay for the horses right from the start."
"Tell me," Linley said. She gave him the A to Z of it, from the journey to Ludlow with its one stop for petrol and one for the loo, to the shared drinks and dinner. She didn't spare herself. What she needed from him was a way to proceed at this point, as she would see the DCS in some 30 minutes. Her insides were telling her that confessing her sins to Linley might prevent her from committing more of them. "A martini and wine," Linley said at the conclusion of her confession. "That's rather heavy going for you, Barbara. Did you not think—"
"That's just it. I didn't think. She said we could have something since we were off duty, and there was this bloke standing there. His name is Peace on Earth, if you can credit that, and so we could have whatever. There was this drinks menu with all sorts of names. What the bloody hell is a sunset in New Mexico anyway? And I reckon—" "I don't know what I reckoned, so I said I'd have what she was having. Some kind of vodka in a glass the size of my mum's Easter bonnet. Then wine. I had coffee after, but the damage was done, and she knew I was pissed. I mean, how could she not know? I'm lucky I didn't throw up on the stairs. Meantime, she's not even the tiniest. I mean, she stumbled a bit when she was leaving the room to take a phone call, but that was it. She wasn't even slurring her words."
Linley took this on board for a moment before saying, "I shouldn't worry."
"But do I say sorry? Do I tell her I generally only have ale or lager and one at that, and mostly once a week anyway?"
"Don't do that." Linley's answer was swift.
He went on to say, "Aside from testing you, and you had to be expecting that, Barbara, how is she otherwise?
Herself. The Queen Bee, the legend, the goddess, whatever. Only, like I said, she had a phone call last night from someone. She took it, but all I heard was that she was employing someone to handle something, and she didn't sound chuffed about the call."
He was silent a moment. She wondered if he was asking himself whether he should hand over some information to her. She wished he would. It might serve to make her time with Audrey easier. But she decided not to put him in the position of having to make a choice. He was first and foremost a gent. If Audrey had confided in him, he wasn't going to break that confidence for love, money, or loyalty to Barbara Havers. He said, "If you think the drinking last night was a test..."
"If,"
she said. "Just be warier. No need to accept when something's offered. A polite refusal is all that's necessary. How are you feeling this morning?"
"I don't have a word for it."
"Ah, do your best not to let her know how badly it's sitting with you, and I expect you'll be fine."
"I just..."
Barbara saw how badly she wanted to blurt out the real reason for her call. She wished he were there in Ludlow, either acting the part of Isabel Ardrey's second or acting the part of her, Barbara's, Gov. She understood quickly enough that the latter was the case, so it was best not to conclude the sentence. "You just..." he prompted her.
"I just hope I can swallow some breakfast."
"Yes, well, we've all been there at least once, Sergeant. Soldier on." He rang off then. Barbara wasn't sure she felt any better than she'd felt before making the call. There was no help for it, however. She had to go down to breakfast. She found the DCS just ending a call on her mobile. Peace on Earth was arriving at the table with a coffee press. Audrey asked him to do the honours and added,
"We're going to need more than one, I dare say,"
after a glance at Barbara. That alone put Barbara into the position of having to say something, so she chose a hearty,
"I'll be drinking tap water from now on.
I might go out on a limb and add one piece of ice and a slice of lime, though." Audrey's lips moved in a smile so faint it could have been a tick. She said,
"You might get two pieces of ice, I found. Have some coffee."
She reached for her own and had it black. There was a tremor in her hand. Barbara said,
"I went walkabout last night."
"That's admirable, considering your condition," was something that Audrey didn't add.
"How did you find Fair Ludlow?" "Not as well lit as it might have been. A few back lanes waiting for the next mugging to happen. But I located the police station, which is what I set out to see."
"And?" Peace on Earth showed up with a second coffee press and his waiter's pad. Audrey went, astoundingly, for the full English breakfast. Barbara chose porridge, reckoning she might be able to gag that down. Peace looked as if he expected more of her. Certainly one couldn't cope with a day ahead without piling on the grub. She said,
"That's it, then,"
and refrained from mentioning that her usual fare was a Pop-Tart or two and a cup of tea. When he'd taken himself off to see to the meal, Barbara told Audrey what she'd discovered at the unmanned police station. She included the information about the CCTV camera, the location of the intercom phone, the notice informing users what to do in the event their report concerned sexual offenders, the open window at the police station indicating its occasional use, just as the chief constable had explained it, and finally the panda car in the car park with the police officer lounging within it.
"I had a think about that," she said to Audrey. "The bloke inside the car last night. I figured him for one of the area's patrol officers, having a kip, while the other does part of the night-time drive about the district. He gives this bloke an hour, perhaps two, and then they switch it up and it's nap time all over again. This time for the other patrol officer."
"How does that relate to the matter in hand?" Audrey spoke over the top of her cup. She'd downed her first coffee and had gone for a second.
"Could be the PCSO was snoozing that night when Druitt died, this Gary Ruddock bloke. Could be he was outside in a car."
"But why would he do that? There was no one in the building aside from himself and Ian Druitt, was there?
Or he was having a kip in one of the offices inside the station. Point is that it's the kip part that got me thinking. It doesn't make sense that Druitt was able to off himself while the PCSO was in the building and fully functioning on duty and all that. Something had to be different about that night. I'm just suggesting that the PCSO asleep might be it."
Audrey nodded. "That would certainly put him into it, wouldn't it?
All right, then. Have at the PCSO this morning. See what you can get beyond what we already have. Compare what he says to you with what he said to D.I. Pyre and the IPCC. He'll be in the picture about our being here, though, so there's no point to thinking there might be a surprise involved when you turn up. Also, have him show you where the suicide occurred. Right. Can do. But I'm also thinking we ought to... Yes?
Audrey sounded interested, but her eyes narrowed in that way she had.
The PCSO, Barbara said quickly, changing course. Can do. Will do.
Audrey gave that tick of a smile.
Very good. Meantime, I've been in touch with Clive Druitt. One of his breweries is just in Kidderminster. I'll be meeting up with him there and smoothing the way opposite the direction of a lawsuit. Evidently, he wishes to give me an earful on why the boy, as he calls him, would never have hanged himself, since suicide is an abomination before God, as he put it. We shall see about all that, I dare say.
Ludlow, Shropshire. When she made a phone call to PCSO Gary Ruddock to arrange an interview, Barbara discovered that his availability was dependent upon someone called Old Rob, who turned out to be an elderly pensioner in whose home Ruddock had a room. He needed to see his doctor this morning, did Old Rob, and as this visit to his doctor had to do with the old bloke's bladder, his prostate, and his worsening incontinence, it wasn't something that could wait. But Ruddock would meet D.S. Havers at the police station after the appointment, round 11:30. He sounded a nice enough bloke. Having an elderly parent herself, Barbara was sympathetic to his situation, although she did not live with her mum and hadn't done in quite some time. But seeing to Old Rob's needs appeared to be part of Gary Ruddock's remit as his living companion, so she agreed to the plan. This left her at loose ends. She wondered if she should ring DCS Audrey and ask what the other officer would have her do while Audrey herself was attempting to make nice with Ian Druitt's dad. But she dismissed this plan as completely lacking in initiative. Linley wouldn't have expected it of her. She had the time to walk over to St. Lawrence Church, if she could find it in the rat's nest of Ludlow's ancient lanes, and nearby would probably be the vicarage. Questioning the vicar about his deacon along the lines of what did he know and when did he know it seemed a viable alternative to lounging round the hotel waiting for Gary Ruddock to be free. Outside, she found that the morning was due to unfold into a glorious day. Across the street, the lawns in front of the castle glittered with the previous night's rain, and in the flower beds, spiky blue flowers mixed with cheerful white and yellow blooms. Her plan of the town told her that a route diagonally through Castle Square would put her roughly in the vicinity of St. Lawrence Church, buried amidst medieval buildings that had sprung up round it through the centuries. The square itself was peopled by merchants who were setting up for the day's open-air market, one that was going to feature mostly foodstuffs, heavily given to baked goods if the aromas were anything to go by. At the north end of the square, Barbara found Church Street, one of two exceedingly narrow lanes that led east, along which a variety of tiny shops offered everything from cheese to chess sets. St. Lawrence was tucked just beyond this area, with its west side facing a horseshoe of curiously high-end-looking almshouses. There were two entrances to the building, on the south and the west, with the southern entrance seeming the main one. Since the church itself suggested someone's presence within it, and since someone's presence suggested information as to the location of the vicarage, Barbara decided she would have a look round. The church was certainly unexpected, not only in location, hidden away as it was, save for its crenellated central tower, but also in its size. The place was huge, which suggested the wealth of the town in the distant past from the wool trade, as was usually the case. It was constructed of sandstone, ruddy in colour, with distinguished buttresses, perpendicular windows, and spires surmounting each corner of its tower. At its north end, a small churchyard took shade from ancient yews, and above, jackdaws wheeled noisily in an azure sky. The place was open. Barbara ducked inside, where she found herself not in contemplative silence as she thought she might be, but rather in the position of eavesdropper upon an argument between an older and a younger woman about how many floral displays were going to be truly necessary, Vanessa, to decorate the place for an upcoming wedding. "We're not exactly paupers, Mum," Vanessa was petulantly pointing out. "And I don't intend to become one," Mum said. "You've two sisters, and they're going to want weddings as well." They drifted towards the end of the chancel, where a perpendicular window dazzled with ancient glass that had somehow escaped Thomas Cromwell's notice. Barbara left them to it because she had seen a man heading in the direction of a chapel that featured yet another enormous window, again stained glass, and a small altar beneath this.